All right, we're back in the After Dark, and I'm Brad Kelly, joined by joined by my doppelganger, Brad Kelly, and Brad Kelly's doppelganger, Dylan Brad Kelly.
Getting confused. It's getting confusing in here.
No, yeah. I'm Kevin Katzman. You know who I am. You're on Patreon. Thank you. Yeah. I got to do the Patreon smooch. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Your support makes this podcast possible and means a lot to us. So, Dylan, that was a good time. I really appreciate your thoughtful, insights into Hemingway. And on this After Dark, we're going to talk about Kilimanjaro, and we're going to talk about the Garden of Eden. So I want to, I don't know, Brad, I know you have a limited amount of time for this, for this After Dark, but tell me, so tell people your story about actually climbing Kilimanjaro. Dylan, have you ever been to Africa? Have you ever climbed a mountain like this? Like when Brad told me this story, I'm like, I feel like I barely know you, Brad. Have you ever done this, Dylan?
No, just kind of gentle slopes. No mountainous terrain. So don't tell us, Brad.
Fair enough. Yeah, it would have been 2008, January of 2008. Me and some friends and I went to Africa to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. We had a safari associated with it, which was really cool. And, you know, that's standard sort of Southern Africa kind of stuff to do. But climbing Kilimanjaro, there's a bunch of different ways to do it. It's a fairly commercial enterprise now. I don't know that it would have. Well, it certainly wasn't to that extent in Hemingway's time. And I'm sure you could pay guides and porters and that sort of thing. But now it's a fairly commercial enterprise. There's a number of different routes you can go. We took what is technically the easiest route, which is what they call the Coca-Cola route. And they call it the Coca-Cola route because coming down the mountain, there's like local guys who are sort of wandering around halfway up the mountain selling Coca-Cola and potato chips and stuff like that. So you know, if the image you have is of like
the American
Reinhold
century.
Messner, like you know, like whipping wind in their face, that's not quite true. But at the same time, it is physically demanding. I mean, you can't go and just do it with no thoughtful preparation whatsoever. It's, 5 days of pretty arduous, consistent hiking. You've got to get acclimated. We had some challenges because we didn't spend the time to get acclimated that is generally recommended. The last day, summit day, you wake up at midnight. And it's pretty darn cold. You're at about 17,000 feet or so, if I remember correctly. And you're going up to just over 20,000 feet high. I believe I could be wrong about that. And you wake up at midnight and then you just hike until dawn. Almost feels like straight up, switchbacking up this sort of scree field. And it's quite an intense experience. There's still a glacier up there. I know there's a lot of talk about how there's not going to be a glacier up there eventually. That could be true, but there still is one. In the beginning of Hemingway's Snows of Kilimanjaro, there is a bit, like a little epigraph, though I think he wrote it, where he says, Kilimanjaro is a snow-covered mountain, 19,710 feet high. Okay, there you go. There's the height. And is said to be the highest mountain in Africa. Its western summit is called the Masai Ngaje Ngai, the House of God. Closer to the western summit, there is a dried and frozen carcass of a leopard. No one has explained what the leopard was seeking at that altitude. I have to tell you, that is very strange because there from the peak, there isn't a tree or a living creature anywhere for miles. So I don't know if there, in fact, is a leopard up there. There was at one time. That is pretty mysterious. I don't know what that thing would be doing up there.
When you told me the story at our annual retreat slash trust exercise slash tax write-off up in Michigan, you explained that you start to lose your mind. You start to get irrationally angry as you climb or something to this effect. Is that?
Yeah. So the oxygen deprivation starts to have curious effects on you physiologically and psychologically. You definitely started to, my brother began to, as we were walking, he began to hallucinate that in his periphery, that little children were running by. So we're in the dark, pitch dark, the darkest you've ever seen. You might as well be in a cave other than your little headlamp. And in his periphery, he kept seeing little children run by. And I think he said he was even hearing them at one point. I didn't quite have any like hallucinations like that, but I definitely got into a strange mood that was fairly uncharacteristic. I got really, for lack of a better word, I got really bitchy with everybody. Like, and it wasn't just exhaustion. Like, that was probably a factor, but it was like, it literally starts affecting your personality and your decision-making process. You start slowing down and not being able to make connections between things. You start just shedding IQ points. Just like, I think by the time, you know, by the time we were up there, I probably couldn't have done like a, I probably could have done 2 plus 2, but I probably couldn't have done like, you know, 3 times 7, right? Like,
very similar to my experience in grad school.
Yeah.
by the end of those 3 years, you were that was what you were. Yeah. Very similar. Would you recommend it, Brad?
Oh, it's great. Going? It's great. Yeah? It's great. Great time. Africa. Well, we were in Tanzania for a little over 2 weeks all told, and it's great. I mean, the thing is, not only the climb is amazing, and the views. I mean, the one thing about Kilimanjaro, saying it's the tallest mountain in Africa is true. The one thing that is never going to be able to convey to you is the fact that it has one of the highest degrees of what they call exposure. So when you have typically a large mountain like that is part of a range of also very tall mountains. And so Everest has a mountain that's, you know, 5,000 feet, some degree shorter right next to it. Africa is basically, this mountain's practically coming out of the ocean. So it's like, you can see, it feels like you can see the entire planet. Like, the view is, it's hard to even comprehend how far you can see. And I remember, not even when we were at the top, there's two peaks and there's a sort of a saddle between them. And I remember the guide, we were asking him what we were looking at. And he basically said that we were looking at the Indian Ocean. But if you look at a map, it's not that close to the Indian Ocean. It's like you were seeing a long, long, long way. So that is something, being on the roof of the world. Yeah.
In the interest of time, let's put a button on that. Brad, thank you for sharing that. That's extremely cool. And let me just say, this does make the case for actually going and doing things.
Oh, you definitely should do it. Yeah.
You should definitely go and do things and then write about them. You don't always want to end up being at your desk all the time. No. It's important to stay at the desk. Dylan is totally right when he mentioned that. It is a war to stay at the desk, but there are other things to do. Let's get into the Garden of Eden real quick. And I want to read, I'm going to read like the first few paragraphs of this. And there's some French here, and my French is poor. But and then Dylan, I want to ask you a little bit about this style. This is the beginning of it. They were living at Le Gras du Roi then, and the hotel was on a canal that ran from the walled city of Aigues-Mortes straight down the sea. They could see the towers of Aigues-Mortes across the low plain of the Camargue, and they rode there on their bicycles at some time of nearly every day along the white road that bordered the canal. In the evenings and the mornings, when there was a rising tide, sea bass would come into it, and they would see the mullet jumping wildly to escape from the bass and watch the swelling bulge of the water as the bass attacked. A jetty ran out into the blue and pleasant sea, and they fished from the jetty and swam on the beach, and each day helped the fishermen haul in the long net that brought the fish up onto the long sloping beach. They drank aperitifs in the cafe on the corner facing the sea and watched the sails of the mackerel fishing boats out in the Gulf of Lions.
it was late in the spring and the mackerel were running and fishing people of the port were very busy. It was a cheerful and friendly town, and the young couple liked the hotel, which had four rooms upstairs and a restaurant and two billiard tables downstairs facing the canal and the lighthouse. The room they lived in looked like the painting of Van Gogh's room at Arles, except there was a double bed and two big windows, and you could look out across the water and marsh and sea meadows to the white town and bright beach of Palavas. They were always hungry, and they ate very well. They were hungry for breakfast, which they ate at the cafe, ordering brioche and cafe au lait and eggs. And the type of preserve that they chose and the manner in which the eggs were to be cooked was an excitement. They were always so hungry for breakfast that the girl often had a headache until the coffee came. But the coffee took the headache away. She took her coffee without sugar, and the young man was learning to remember that.
I love that.
What do we make of that, Dylan?
Yeah, so that's kind of just a kind of quintessential Hemingway, it sounds to me, even if the novel takes a interesting right turn at some points. But yeah, so again, like even when you're reading it, it's like the staccato of the style. It's like it's syllabically, it's so sparse. It's like they're butting up against each other. And I think he paid real attention to that kind of rhythm as well. I think he's like, I read somewhere that's like 70% of his sentences don't even have a comma. They're simple sentences straight through. And then another cool thing is the and the use of that, where he actually had a problem with full stops. He used to, when he wrote freehand, he used to do an X on the page because he didn't like to come to that stop where, you know, where you might pause and then start overthinking. So it was to keep the hand constantly moving. And if he got to the end of a page, he wouldn't finish the sentence there. He would like immediately break off, even if there was space, and he'd start it again on the next page, just so there was like a constant flow writing back and forth. And then, and it also has like a kind of an incantational, like, and they went, it's biblical, the way he's doing it. And like, you know, then they were hungry and they were hungry for breakfast. It's like almost like a Martin Luther King speech or something like that, that kind of repetition as well. So it's like, so again, when you read it, it's like, well, like, fuck it, it's just talking about like, you know, beaches and boats. But then when you start to see what he's doing, kind of, you know, stylistically, even though it looked like there was nothing going on, it kind of opens up.
I think, though, that's all great. I think Hemingway really benefits from being read aloud as well. There's something that really, if you're reading some Hemingway and you don't get what's so special about this style, try reading it aloud. And I think it's a case, and this isn't always the case for prose, but I think in Hemingway, it really does benefit from being spoken aloud. Not that it was meant to, but.
And with that in mind, allow me to read one more bit of this, okay? Mm-hmm. And this is a critical scene that happens rather early in the novel. This is the end of page 14 and going 15. He found that he had drunk the fin à l'eau and that it was getting late in the afternoon. He ordered another and started to concentrate on the paper, but the paper did not interest him as it should, and he was looking out at the sea with late afternoon sun heavy on it when he heard her coming into the cafe and say in her throaty voice, "Hello, darling." She came quickly to the table and sat down and lifted her chin and looked at him with the laughing eyes and the golden face and the tiny freckles. Her hair was cropped as short as a boy's. It was cut with no compromises. It was brushed back, heavy as always, but the sides were cut short and the ears that grew close to her head were clear and the tawny line of her hair was cropped close to her head and smooth and sweeping back. She turned her head and lifted her breasts and said, "Kiss me, please." He kissed her and looked at her face and at her hair, and he kissed her again. "Do you like it? Feel it how smooth. Feel it in back," she said. He felt it in back. "Feel on my cheek and feel in front of my ear. Run your fingers up at the sides. You see," she said, "that's the surprise. I'm a girl, but now I'm a boy too. And I can do anything and anything and anything." "Sit here by me," he said. "What do you want, brother?" "Oh, thank you," she said. "I'll take what you're having. You see why it's dangerous, don't you?" "Yes, I see. But wasn't I good to do it?" "Maybe." And it goes on like that, and it's a romance.
Yeah.
Wow. Dylan,
Yeah. See, it's wild. Like, you wouldn't guess it was him. Except, but you probably wouldn't guess it was him written down. But even as you read it aloud, you can still hear it's the same style, just covering completely different terrain. Touch it at back or something. He's like, you know, he's like, whole words are kind of missing syntactically. Yeah, that's cool. And I read, on the wiki, I think it even says, people dive into further, like that his mom used to dress up. She was like this kind of like staunch Victorian. Like the way it was done was the boys and girls dressed the same. Yeah. He'd go around in kind of frocks with long hair, like until he was like, you know, 3 or 4, looking so he could consciously remember that. So then, and then you kind of parallel that with this kind of machismo, bravado, you know, boxing, fighting, hunting, punching. Mm-hmm. Adulthood then is, you know, the overcompensation perhaps.
Yeah. Let me give just a little background. I know, Brad, you've got to go in a minute here, but this is from the Wikipedia, just to give some context. So the novel was published posthumously in 1986 in a much abridged form. He began The Garden of Eden in 1946.
Whoa.
And wrote 800 pages. All right. For 15 years, he continued to work on the novel, which remained incomplete. The manuscript of The Garden of Eden exists in 3 irreconcilable drafts of varying lengths, the longest of which was chosen to be the basis of the published text. When published in 86, the novel had 30 chapters and 70,000 words, with a publisher's note that explains that cuts were made to the novel. And according to biographers, Hemingway had achieved 48 chapters and 200,000 words. Oh. Scribner's removed as much as 2/3 of the manuscript and 1 long subplot. And so there's some controversy here. Is it really a Hemingway novel?
Right.
I don't know.
It is interesting, and it's hard to not want to read it a little bit if you're a Hemingway fan, right?
If you're a Hemingway completist, I think you need to read it, and you're probably going to do a lot better picking it up rather than going to some random book on the shelves
The one thing I would say is don't base your entire opinion of Hemingway on this book.
Don't start with it.
Right.
Excellent. Very, very cool. Well, Dylan, thank you so much for your time. Brad, I know you have some parental duties coming up. I kind of soft announced it on the last episode, but I'm going to have some more parental duties next year. So the family's growing. So it's early, but we're excited. And hopefully everything goes well. And I'm going to share it with the Patreon family in a really explicit way. So thank you, Patreon patrons. We really appreciate it. You know, I like to think of Patreon as our own little Garden of Eden.
How are you going to say your own little family? But
yeah. I'll get back to you on that one, Kevin.
Thanks again. Thanks, Dylan.